loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is on his way back from Pyongyang with three former American prisoners in tow. Pompeo was in North Korea for meetings that would lay the groundwork for President Trump's upcoming meeting with Kim Jong-un. Meanwhile, Kim was in Beijing consulting with the Chinese for the same reason. Next, mainstream Republicans and Democrats won most of their races in primaries yesterday in West Virginia, Ohio, Indiana, and North Carolina. Don Blankenship, the mining company CEO, jailed for a year for his role in the deaths of 29 miners, lost his race for U.S. Senate in West Virginia. Former Consumer Financial Protection Bureau Director Richard Cordray won the Democratic nomination for governor in Ohio. Vice President Pence's brother won the Republican nomination for a congressional seat in Indiana. And incumbent Republican Congressman Robert Pittenger of North Carolina lost his race to a far-right-wing former pastor. Then Stormy Daniels' attorney is alleging that Trump attorney Michael Cohen received $500,000 from a company controlled by a Russian oligarch, with the money being deposited into an account for a company that was in turn used to pay off the adult film actress. And CNN is reporting that Robert Mueller's investigators have questioned an unnamed Russian oligarch about payments into that account. And then yesterday, a global trending hashtag on Twitter was hashtag tamam, or enough, in response to Turkish President Erdogan. Erdogan has called snap presidential elections on June 24th, and polls show that he may be in jeopardy. And finally, as Donald Trump pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal yesterday, Israel sent missiles into Syria targeting an Iranian base. This morning, there are reports of 15 dead, including 8 Iranians. Israel's military, the Israel Defense Forces, announced that they were opening bomb shelters in anticipation of retaliation from Iran. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
But first, we turn to the visit by Mike Pompeo to the DPRK. He's now on his way back from Pyongyang with three former American prisoners in tow. Pompeo was in North Korea for meetings that would lay the groundwork for President Trump's upcoming meeting with Kim Jong-un. Meanwhile, Kim was in Beijing consulting with the Chinese for the same reason. We're joined from London by Jude Woodward. She is the author of the new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. And we're joined from Toronto by Chris Black. Chris is an international criminal lawyer who was on the list of counsel before the International Criminal Court. Jude and Chris, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on.
Hi there.
Thanks. Jude Woodward, I mean, a lot of dynamic diplomacy going on. Kim Jong-un back in China again, meeting with Xi Jinping, while Pompeo was on his way to the DPRK. What's your takeaway right now? What is the DPRK doing in relationship to the Chinese leadership? Obviously, there was a big strain in the relationship over the past years. It seems to be in many ways mending. But anyway, what's your take?
Well, first, I'd say I think the strain in the relationship existed, but was always rather exaggerated in the West. But I would say there's very close collaboration now. This is clearly a joint DPRK Chinese effort in relation to getting some settlement in Korea. And now we have to wait and see whether the Americans are going to play ball. I mean, the key thing on what Trump has said, we won't get very far, to be honest, because Trump has said there will be no incremental steps by the U.S. before total denuclearization by North Korea. Well, that's not reasonable, in the same way as the trade terms that Trump has put down in front of China is not reasonable. If you want a settlement, you have to be prepared to make some kind of deal, not just present ultimatums. So we'll see what actually happens. But clearly, there is a big shift in the center of gravity of how the politics of East Asia sorts itself out, because I would put on the table as well the three-way meeting between Li Keqiang, Moon Jae-in, and Abe, the first Japan-South Korea-China summit for 2.5 years, which is clearly also connected to this unfolding diplomacy in Korea. And I think indicates a shift away from the predominant role of the U.S. The U.S. still has a vast role and can scupper the whole thing, but it's not just on its own. It doesn't just rule the waves.
Chris Black, what do you think the chances are then of some sort of a grand agreement? If Donald Trump says that there won't be incremental agreements and the North Koreans really are looking for something meaningful here, do you think that there really is a chance for, let's say, denuclearization in exchange for a peace treaty or trade agreement or something else?
Well, that's been the North Korean position since for the last 30 years, that they're willing to stop their nuclear weapons program in exchange for a peace treaty and a non-aggression pact. And the United States has refused to give it all this time. And the last time they had a deal, a nuclear deal back in the 90s, the American government reneged on that, which forced them into this position. And they're now offering the same position. We're still willing to get rid of our nuclear weapons. We'd be happy to if you just sign a peace treaty and agree not to attack us. I think it's a bit naive, but that's what they're willing to do. And they'd be making concessions all along. They just released these prisoners. The American government's offering nothing except bluster and distorting the whole narrative by saying that Korea's submitting to the United States from pressure, when it's the exact opposite. And I agree with Judy that the Chinese rapprochement with DPRK is very important and seems to be very strong. And in the New York Times today, I saw an article. They put up an op-ed piece saying that DPRK wants to go away from China and come closer to the United States. They're trying to split China and the DPRK. That's what they're trying to do, to cause trouble. So, I mean, it's possible that an important deal could be made if the United States has the bona fide intentions to make one. But I doubt that very much.
Well, let's just look at that issue, Jude, because there has been a lot of commentary that somehow the United States is trying to do with the DPRK what Nixon essentially did when with the opening to China in the early 1970s was to create an alliance or a semi-alliance against another third party. In the case of China, it was against the Soviet Union in the early 70s. It seems to me, I mean, I don't really know, but it seems to me to be a sort of a ludicrous notion, given the fact that China and the DPRK share this big border, that even though the China went along with the U.S. in very harsh economic sanctions against the DPRK, China can very easily, if not officially, in an unofficial way, open that border for trade. And it seems to me that Kim Jong-un is going out of his way to make it clear to the Chinese leadership that the DPRK has no such intention. I mean, that would be the point of having these two meetings.
Well, that's how I would read it, too. I would read it. The meeting, the second meeting in Dalian, I think, just underlined that there is close coordination between the DPRK and China as to how to handle these talks. And I thought the body language of Kim Jong-un and Xi Jinping was very relaxed. They were two people discussing things in a very close and relaxed way. I think it is almost inconceivable that the US would succeed in some tactic of splitting the DPRK from China in a real sense. I don't rule it out completely. Many stranger things have happened in the world, but it's not what I am looking at as the most likely scenario emerging from the current situation. I think the real situation we face in North Korea or in the Korean Peninsula, is that the U.S.'s influence in the region is weakening. Moon Jae-in wants peace on the peninsula, as does the overwhelming majority of the population, not just of South Korea, but of the entire world. And both Kim Jong-un and Moon Jae-in have been prepared to pursue finding some settlement using relations with regional leaders, including the meeting with Abe, DPRK's relationship with China, to force the US into a quick step on towards talks. Now, whether the US will continue or scupper it, I think that's the big question, not whether they can divide the DPRK from China.
Yeah, I agree. I think you're right that it seems to me also that China has been a big influence on the DPRK and supporting them in order to bring about these talks, along with the South Korean leadership, to try and get around the United States. And if they can establish a peace treaty, there is no real need for American forces to stay in the Korean Peninsula. So I agree that the American position is weakening as the regional powers try and resolve this outside the box and then present to the Americans a fait accompli that there's no need for you to be here anymore. And the Americans are trying to maintain a position, whichever way they can. And the article in the op-ed of the New York Times was an attempt to maybe create division, which isn't there, between the DPRK and China, which is impossible to create, as I agree with Judy. But they may try to do that.
Yeah. It seems to me also that the stage is being set for a number of scenarios to play out, and they're completely contradictory scenarios. If the DPRK does not accede to Trump's demands, or if the demands are too excessive, and if Trump walks out on the talks, you also have John Bolton, who really wants a war somewhere, and why not Iran and Korea, and you have Pompeo. These guys would quickly form into a war cabinet. Anyway, Jude Woodward, we have a minute left. Do you agree that this is we're coming to a fork in the road, and they take us in very, very, very different places?
Yeah, we're definitely approaching a fork in the road, and I think Trump is pursuing a very dangerous course in Iran with the trade ultimatum to China, and we'll see what happens in Korea. But I think that overall the U.S. position is weakening, but it's still immensely powerful and can make a lot of trouble.
Yeah, that's true. I don't think people should underestimate the still robust power of the United States or the Trump administration and what it's capable of.
And nothing's been agreed to yet. You know, we're all talking about how optimistic we are and we're hoping for the best, but this is not a certainty.
Yeah, not at all. Anyway, we're out of time. We've been joined from London by Jude Woodward. She is the author of the new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. And we're joined from Toronto by Chris Black. He is an international criminal lawyer who is on the list of counsel before the ICC, the International Criminal Court. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In this segment, we're going to talk about the primary outcomes yesterday. We're joined from Washington, D.C. by Jacqueline Lookman. She's an editor with Lookman Nation, and by Travis Booth. He is an organizer in the Morgantown area in West Virginia. Jacqueline and Travis, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
All right, Jackie, let's start with you. You're following the big picture here with primaries and the electoral results and what they might mean for the upcoming midterm elections. Let's talk with Travis about West Virginia, but maybe you could take us through Ohio and some of the other states.
So the big news in Ohio was that Dennis Kucinich lost, but reports are saying that his old platform is still the future of the Democratic Party. So it appears that all of the issues, well, some of the issues that progressives were fighting for, which are pushing for a $15 minimum wage, universal pre-K, Medicaid expansion or free Medicaid, Medicare for all, are making inroads into the Democratic Party. And even in his loss, they're saying that the Democrats would be foolish to ignore these issues that are gaining popularity among the Democratic base, especially since last week we talked about some longtime Democrats demanding that Hillary Clinton pay back their money from the money they gave to her for her presidential campaign that didn't go to the down ballot candidates. So progressives are making a few inroads in the Democratic Party. And even though Blankenship lost in West Virginia, the fact that he got 20% of the vote, I think, is being ignored by the fact that the Republicans are saying, ooh, we dodged a bullet by this guy losing. But 20% of the vote is nothing to sneeze at.
Let's turn to Travis Booth. Travis is there in Morgantown. You've been organizing, as have many other organizers and activists against Blankenship before this electoral cycle. We had the Republican Party coming in strong, including Trump, to try to make sure that he didn't get the nomination. Anyway, when you look back at yesterday's results, what's your big takeaway?
Yeah, I would have to agree with the sentiment, you know, expressed by everybody on the call right now. Whenever I was originally interviewed, we were talking about Blankenship a couple months back, and there was no real thought that he could ever make it this far. But the fact that he did, you know, tells us something very interesting. You know, one, you know, there is increasing fear among the ruling class, as exemplified by the fact that so many establishment Republicans, including Donald Trump himself, were willing to just throw him under the bus completely in an attempt to consolidate power. But at the same time, there was also fear that there's an increasingly progressive base waking up here in West Virginia that could also threaten the established hegemony of the establishment Democrats and Republicans alike. So yes, the victory against Don Blankenship, the isolation of Don Blankenship, was a progressive step forward. But I think one of the more interesting aspects is the way that the Democratic Party itself has reacted to this primary. You had incumbent Joe Manchin, who was squaring off against Paula Jean Swearengin, which was the direct result of the Bernie Sanders campaign's fallout. And she really was able to galvanize a large segment of the progressive base here in West Virginia in an attempt to challenge Joe Manchin. So I think that that shows that the Democratic Party and the Republican Party alike are far more alike in their attempts to maintain control of the established political order. And they're really fearful of, you know, outsiders, you know, whether or not that's on the far right or on the more progressive left. And I think that's the more interesting takeaway of yesterday's primary.
Yeah, Manchin's progressive opponent got 3 out of 10 Democratic voters. It is I think it's significant. It comes in West Virginia. Of course, West Virginia was the site of the teacher strike. Just real quick, Travis, do you think in general, as you're seeing West Virginia politics play out, it seems like there's a lot of dynamism now. Things a lot of times are static. They seem like they're never moving. Nothing's changing. There's a lot of apathy. But that seems to have really been turned upside down in West Virginia. Do you see it that way?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, people are looking for answers. You know, recently, since 2014, I believe, you know, the state has been under the control of the GOP. And before that, around 70 to 80 years of Democratic Party control. And I think people are just looking for something. You know, they want answers one way or another. And I think that's led to this, you know, polarity of statewide politics, you know, that's culminated recently in the teacher strike, and who, you know, was really directed against the Republicans, including Governor Jim Justice, who was elected as a Democrat. So I don't think there's party loyalty necessarily on either the right or the left here in this state. People just are looking for answers. I think that's the only real takeaway here.
Jackie, the Republican establishment, including Trump, were trying to you know, beat down the more even further to the right candidates because they fear losing control of the House or the Senate in the 2018 election. They want stronger mainstream. It's hard to say what's mainstream anymore. I mean, I think actually that word is so trite and so meaningless. The whole political discourse at one level has gone further and further to the right. And then you have the subterranean movements to the left that are keep bubbling up and looking for and trying to find expression. Let's spend a little bit more time on North Carolina, if we could.
It's interesting that you point out the discourse among Republicans not wanting to lose their party to kind of fringe forces when the Tea Party wave was basically a fringe force. And what we're seeing now is that fringe force pretty much going off the rails. And it's interesting to watch the Republicans lose, kind of trying to hold on to that fringe position. It's even hard to explain, but because we're not sure where this party, the Republican Party, is. Is it far right? Is it trying to regain its soul? And in North Carolina, with Rep. Pittenger, with him losing the primary, he is the first congressman defeated in a primary this year, which is, and his story is really interesting. He's a pastor, which, you know, we're seeing all of this focus on, renewed focus on family values and the evangelical wing of the Republican Party. So it's interesting to see a pastor lose in the Republican primary. And I say this as a Christian. That's very, very interesting. He was elected in 2012, nearly lost to his challenger in 16, just barely squeaking by with a 134-vote margin. But he was under federal investigation for allegedly transferring money to his campaign in 2012 from his real estate company. I am so confused by the Republican Party. And I think most Republican voters are kind of confused, too, because I'm not sure. Well, I'm pretty positive they don't have much to choose from. There's no policy. It's all ideology. And it's all either extremist Trumpism, nearly fascist ideology, or more of the same. And people are not, even Republican voters, are not accepting more of the same because it's not benefiting their lives.
Let's jump back to Travis. We only have about 2 minutes left. While the Republican Party is trying to battle down or bat down the extreme right, and, you know, our friend Randy Credico uses this comedic line, there's a fine line between the right, the far right, and the Third Reich. And I think that, you know, we see a lot of political manifestations of extreme right-wing politics right now in the Republican Party and around the country. But the Democrats also really moved hard to stop the surge of Dennis Kucinich, who was perhaps the most left-wing member or one of the most left-wing members of Congress when he was serving. Again, this is an attempt by the Democratic Party to beat down the Bernie Sanders liberal wing of the Democratic Party, and they succeeded in Ohio. We have 1 minute left. You get the last word.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely hitting the nail on the head there, Brian. You know, I can speak to the experience in West Virginia, my conversations with other progressive Bernie Sanders-esque activists. You know, just an example, you know, the state Democratic Party provided no logistical support towards Paula Jean Swearengin's campaign whatsoever. There was not even a Democratic Party debate, even though that the GOP was able to establish their own debate through Fox News on May 1st. And I think that shows you everything that you need to know about the Democratic Party. If anything, I think what we're going to see is a continued rightward move by the Democratic Party in order to consolidate the moderates and even some of the more right-wing Republicans who, you know, as was previously mentioned, you know, might feel alienated by the Republican base and its far-right rhetoric. So I think that's what we're going to see, is not necessarily a turn to the left, but necessarily a turn to the right following the end of this primary in this election season.
Interesting. Okay, we're going to leave it there. We've been joined from Morgantown, West Virginia by Travis Booth. He's an organizer, a longtime activist in West Virginia. And we've been joined from Washington, D.C. by Jacqueline Lookman. She is the co-editor-in-chief of the Lookman Nation. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Stormy Daniels' attorney is alleging that Trump attorney Michael Cohen received $500,000 from a company controlled by a Russian oligarch, with the money then being deposited into an account for a company that was in turn used to pay off the adult film actress. And CNN is reporting that Robert Mueller's investigators questioned an unnamed Russian oligarch about payments into that account. We're joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and author of The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Daniel, good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel, this sounds complicated. So there's a Russian oligarch, apparently, and he gave $500,000 to Michael Cohen. The money was deposited into an account, a certain corporate account, and that same account was used to pay Stormy Daniels and possibly other women for whatever reason.
So, John, but wait a second. You're talking about a Russian oligarch. You're not talking about AT&T's payment to Michael Cohen to the same
company.
Totally
separate.
Ah.
Totally separate issue.
Okay.
I'm wondering, if this is, you know, I have to admit that I laughed when I first read this because it just sounds so preposterous.
It sounds like pay to play.
It sounds like pay to play. That's right. Which is a whole different issue that we can discuss.
And the one we're not discussing, of the people paying to play was a Russian oligarch.
Right.
Billionaires are oligarchs if they're Russian.
I only hear the word associated with Russians.
Yeah. Anyway, Daniel, go ahead.
Well, as you said, also was another company was Novartis, with a pharmaceutical company.
That's right, and nobody's talking about that.
Well, I think that what we're dealing with here is clearly a Swiss plot to steal the 2016 election.
Trump lawyer linked to Swiss pharmaceutical.
Precisely, Heidi is taking over American politics.
We only learned this information because Stormy Daniels' attorney tweeted it, and what he does, he's actually quite good at this. He'll just tweet out this wild accusation or allegation that may be true, it may be half true, but it gets everybody spun up. And the next thing you know, it's on CNN and MSNBC and everywhere else.
It says so much about Russia Gate. I mean, I'm looking at Daniel, Wall Street Journal, firm linked to oligarch paid Trump lawyer. That's the headline, because obviously all of these companies are paying Donald Trump's lawyer money for something. Well, what would that something possibly be? Again, that's a big problem, I would say, for, quote, democracy, our democracy, when all of these corporations are giving obscene amounts of money to the president's personal lawyer for what? I mean, AT&T is now it sent out a letter to its employees trying to explain to AT&T employees why it gave $800,000 between October 2017. Yes, that would be, you know, 1 year after, 9 months after Trump took office, and January 2018, according to documents reviewed by the New York Times. They say that they wanted to get Michael Cohen, they wanted to consult.
Right, for $500,000.
$800,000.
I might point out that Vexelberg, the so-called oligarch in question, also is a major contributor to the Clinton Family Foundation.
That is different, Daniel. The Clintons can take Russian money. That's not a problem. We know that.
As well as an investor in Gawker. So I guess Gawker is part of the great Russian conspiracy to hijack our democracy.
That's been obvious for a long time.
Clearly, yes.
You know, the truth is really nobody is talking about collusion anymore. I think this whole oligarch thing was just a way to get the word collusion back into the news again, because we haven't seen any kind of evidence of collusion. I mean, we've seen evidence of collusion with the Israeli government, with the Saudi government, but not with the Russian government.
Well, I think no one really knows what collusion really means.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That's an important point.
But I think Russia, I think the Kremlin, properly speaking, did have a favorite in this race. Putin loathes Hillary Clinton, and therefore was quite happy to see Trump slide into office by virtue of the Electoral College. But a lot of countries had an interest in this race, and a lot of them were colluding in various ways in order to get their personal choice in. This whole angle has been vastly exaggerated, and there really was no magic bullet that put Trump over the edge. I mean, it was Clinton's lousy campaign and his rather clever way in which he seized on certain issues that gained him just enough vote and just enough states to win the contest. Everyone's looking for these dark arts. That's the term the New York Times actually used recently. These kind of dark internet arts would somehow magically swung the election, but it just didn't happen.
A Korean aerospace industries confirmed to the Washington Post that it paid $150,000 to Cohen's company. Again, of course, the Koreans are looking to Michael Cohen for a deep insight into U.S.-Korean politics. Well, no, they're not. They're paying Michael Cohen large amounts of money, just like American corporations are paying them, so that they have influence with the White House, so that they can get contracts or that something that they need can be taken care of. There's no other possible way that these companies would be, you know, dispersing huge amounts of money to somebody like Michael Cohen. I mean, again, the headline could be firm linked to Korea, a paid Trump lawyer, firm linked to AT&T, paid Trump lawyer. But it's not the headline, because the point of the headline and the point of the story and the point of Stormy Daniels' hustling lawyer,
right,
is to contribute to and profit from the Russiagate story. I mean, people, I mean,
you got to give this guy credit. He's very good at what he does. He has a real eye for PR. I'm actually impressed by it.
I'm repulsed. I have to say, when I watch this guy on TV, I'm just like, oh my God, he's so repulsive. But you know, all the anti-Trump networks love him because he's always, you know,
That's like,
as if that matters. I mean, you know what, Daniel? Yesterday, Donald Trump, we learned, was cutting the children's health program in half, right? From $15 billion to $7 billion, even though the national debt is increasing 21% because of his tax giveaways and the military spending. Can you imagine, John and Daniel, if MSNBC and CNN spent 24/7 coverage talking about how brutal and barbaric Trump was for trying to take children off of health care gratuitously? I mean, if we did that 24/7, the way they're talking about Stormy Daniels or this thing with the firm of Michael Cohen, the American people would be up in arms against Donald Trump.
They would.
But they're not doing
that. That story's not covered.
It's just so much easier to blame America's dysfunctional political system on another country. You know, to displace it outwards onto Russia. It's just so much easier. It avoids any kind of, you know, self-criticism, self-examination, analysis of where American politics have gone wrong. It's just so convenient, and that's why they're doing it.
Yeah, this is a pay-to-play government. It's also called American democracy. I mean, we get to vote every 2 or 4 years for these rich Congress people or people who aspire to be rich or people who are dependent on other rich people. And then this is the way decisions really get made. Corporations, be they Russian or Swiss or American, are giving the president's lawyers and other people huge amounts of money, and they're buying influence.
This is the way Washington works. I mean, no, the scandal of the Clinton Foundation, the Saudis gave them tens of millions of dollars, the Emiratis, the Qataris as well, to buy influence. There isn't a single foundation, a single think tank in Washington, which doesn't receive Arab Gulf money. And that hugely slants the way the Middle East is covered, the way Iran is covered, for example. So money is what fuels policy making in Washington.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I can't tell you how many times when I was assigned in the Middle East, how many times think tank principals would come out and make the rounds around the Gulf with their hats in their hands and they're just to beg for money. I will make one correction, though. There is one think tank in Washington that will not take any money from governments, whether the American government or foreign governments or any corporations. That's the Institute for Policy Studies. IPS, the preeminent progressive think tank in town. They're broke because of it, but at least their analysis is independent.
Oh, just for the record, the Answer Coalition not only won't take corporate donations, but will never receive one because no corporation would possibly donate to a subversive organization like that. But, and there's others, but John is right. All the others, IPS, oh, IPS is stellar in that way.
Yeah.
The others are not. I mean, again, this is so amazingly stupid, the coverage. The Korean airspace industry, get this. Why did they give Michael Cohen $150,000? They wanted his help to inform their reorganization of our internal accounting system. Ugh. What? Michael Cohen, Trump's lawyer, is helping a Korean aerospace company reorganize its internal accounting system?
Because he's so better at it than PricewaterhouseCoopers.
And his Korean is amazing, I'm sure. I'm sure he could walk right in and say, look, guys, we're going to reorganize your accounting system. I mean, it's funny, except it's not funny. Go ahead, Daniel.
Well, this is just the way things work, and I just can't reiterate how much. And so, it's not the question of the Kremlin in kind of a unique, nefarious way, just fixing the election. You know, this, you have to pay to play in Washington. And money is what greases the wheels. Money buys policy. And so consequently, it's it's not a government so much as a giant stock market where investors are, you know, constantly jockeying for advantage.
There's two important numbers. There's 535 members of Congress, 435 in the House, 100 senators, but there are 15,000 lobbyists right around us here on K Street.
Right.
15,000, that's the shadow government.
That is. That's the shadow government. We're out of time, unfortunately. We were joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. Daniel's a journalist and the author of three great books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Yesterday, a global trending hashtag on Twitter was hashtag tamam, or enough, in response to Turkish President Erdogan. Erdogan has called snap presidential elections on June 24th, and polls show that his government may be in some trouble. We're joined from Spain by Nevzat Evrim. He's a journalist with the Turkish newspaper Sol. Welcome to the show, Nevzat.
Hello. How are you?
Can you explain to our listeners exactly what Erdogan is facing? Now, Erdogan himself is not up for re-election. Is that right? This is the parliament we're talking about.
No. Actually, there will be two elections at the same time. The parliamentary elections and the presidential elections will be held at the same time. So people will be voting both for the parliament and for the president, of which Erdogan is the primary candidate.
I see.
Presidential elections will be held in two rounds, and the candidates with the highest two candidates with the highest votes will go into the second round.
So I'm looking at some polls that have been published in Euronews and some of the Turkish papers. And they're saying that in the first round, Erdogan looks safe, although he doesn't get more than 42%. He's far ahead of the next challenger. But then in the second round, it's very, very close. Is that what you're hearing as well?
Yeah, that is more or less what has been happening.
So how do you see this playing out? What would happen in the event of a split parliament? What does that do to presidential power?
So first of all, let me clearly state something. This election is somehow illegitimate in the sense that the process that brought Turkey into this electoral situation started in the 16th of April of 2016, when a referendum was held, which included some serious changes in the electoral laws and the presidential office, of which the power of the president has been heightened considerably. So in this referendum, it was very close, and it is still argued that there has been a considerable amount of fraud in the referendum process. So the election that will be held on the 24th of June is held under the shadow of this fraud allegations. So we have to state firstly that the main problem with the electoral process right now is this. Secondly, if we come to whether or not Erdogan will win, we have to consider the fact that Erdogan and AKP, his political party, have been holding the power for like more than 16 years now. And we have seen time and again that he is not short on using the powers of the state, the powers of the intelligence, for example, and the police power during the electoral process. He did this more than one time. So the main problem with the electoral process of the 24th of June is that this process is not like we are not going to have a happy democratic electoral process. It is impossible to say that. So if the elections hang on to the second round, if, for example, Erdogan does not win or says that he has won in the first round, and yes, I agree that the numbers are very close, and there is also the possibility that he may win in the presidential elections, but AKP may not win in the parliamentary elections, which will create a governmental lockdown. So this is more or less the situation.
Mm-hmm. We're joined from Spain by Nevzat Evrim. He's a journalist with the Turkish newspaper Sol, and we're talking about upcoming Turkish elections. Nevzat, after the attempted coup against President Erdogan, he purged the military, journalists were arrested, people were expelled from the country, and he sort of turned his attention to the Kurds and leftists and people who were easily attacked. Did those attacks take with the Turkish public? Did the public begin to side with Erdogan, or is his popularity now beginning to wane?
His popularity is definitely on the wane, but we have to look, when talking about the coup of summer 2016, the 16th of July coup, we have to first state that this coup attempt was made by Gulenists in the military and in some parts of the government against Erdogan. So we are talking about two pieces of Islamic reactionary political power fighting with each other on the street, using tanks, using attack helicopters, using fighter bombers. Okay, so after that, the main objective of Erdogan and the AKP government was to purge the state apparatus of people who are against him. The first and foremost among this were Gulenists, and actually, they are not the ones who are objecting to what has been happening, because they have accepted defeat and mostly they left the country. The people who belong to Kurdish political party and people who support the Kurdish political party and people who are more or less leftists, unorganized people, unorganized leftists, for example, academics, journalists, these were persecuted also, but the whole persecution process was more widespread, and it did not only target leftists, and I have to say that in brackets. We have to look at this situation in the view that Erdogan is holding on to power with everything he has, and anybody and any group he deems a threat is something in his eyes to be dealt with, if you know what I'm saying. So we are talking about tired political section of the country, section of the political, the whole political environment, the Islamic reactionary section, and these people, Erdogan and the people that are closest to him, everybody knows that they have become richer considerably during this process, and not through legitimate means. Erdogan is also one of the richest persons in the country. So Erdogan knows that in the case that he is defeated, it will be impossible for him to stay in the country at all. So we are not looking at a normal electoral situation. We are not looking at, like, normally, in the sense that political parties are competing with each other, candidates are competing with each other, the situation is not that clear. In the case that Erdogan loses, the situation that admitting defeat will also for him be a ruin.
So Erdogan is in a situation where he must win, because if he doesn't win, he will be driven from the country or possibly imprisoned or certainly ruined as a political figure.
At least tried in court. But we have to look at the ideological side of the thing. AKP as a political party and Erdogan as a political figure has never been in the, I can't remember the word, but they have always been in power. They have never been in the side that opposes power.
Right, the minority.
Yeah, they have always been in the majority. And the ideology of AKP is built around the concept of power. They are a political party that only means something when they are in power. They are meaningless when they are out of power. their whole working process, their whole ideology, their agenda, all of these presupposes that they are in power. If they are not in power, they are meaningless. They are meaningless for themselves, and they are meaningless for the capitalist class also.
I'm sorry, Nevzat, that we're out of time. We were joined from Spain by Nevzat Evrim. He's a journalist with the Turkish newspaper Sol, and he was discussing upcoming Turkish elections. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're going to take a short break, and we'll come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. As Donald Trump pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal yesterday, Israel sent missiles into Syria targeting Iranian bases or Iranian forces. This morning, there are reports of 15 people dead, including 8 Iranians. Israeli military, the Israeli Defense Forces, announced that they were opening bomb shelters in anticipation of retaliation from Iran. All of that happened, it seemed, as a coordinated set of moves because Donald Trump at that moment was making his speech withdrawing from the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the Iran nuclear arms deal. In this segment, we're going to be joined from Jerusalem by Bob Schlehuber. Bob is the producer of the Radio Sputnik show By Any Means Necessary. Bob Schlehuber, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Why are you in Jerusalem?
Well, we'll be in Jerusalem on Monday for Donald Trump's opening in the United States, opening of the U.S. Embassy. I'm actually in Haifa right now, north of Tel Aviv. And I think, interestingly enough, the conversation on the ground mirrors much of what's happening with Israel dropping bombs in Syria. You have a populace that knows the headlines but isn't engaged. They're tired of the political situation. It's exhausted the people. Getting the sense that people have heard about these bombings. They've heard about the opening of the Jerusalem embassy by the United States. Ultimately, though, I think you're seeing the same problem in the United States without an engaged populace that care about these issues, the Donald Trumps of the world, the Benjamin Netanyahu's of the world, can get away with war crimes, can get away with pulling out of well-reasoned deals that prevent war from happening. And so that's why I'm here to cover it, and the coverage thus far has pretty much been around unengaged, but a knowledgeable populace, but not engaged in a lot of the conversations.
I see. So, you know, one of the things that happened yesterday was the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, a high command, announced that their troops were being put on high alert, and the central government ordered local governments in the northern part of Israel and Golan Heights, which Israel seized from Syria in the 1967 war, to open bomb shelters in preparation for strikes by Iran. But then at that same moment, it was Israel that sent these missiles crashing into Syria, presumably against Iranian forces there. Obviously, there were Syrian forces as well who took casualties. What you're telling us is that there's not really a sense of alarm inside the Israeli body politic, or just what's the mood?
I think it's I think people are on to the game, that the Donald Trumps and Benjamin Netanyahu's use propaganda, at least through messaging and through tactical hyperboles of headlines, that people are stopping at headlines. So right now, if the headlines read, Israel strikes Iran, are prepared for retaliation, or even the headlines that they had detected unusual activities by the Iranians after they were bombed in the region, they had unusual activities. Of course they did, because they're moving quickly from areas that were just bombed. But they understand that the populace is only reading headlines. So in response, if it says bomb shelters in Golan Heights are open, people get a sense of panic. They say, well, it must be a reason for us to bomb Syria and bomb Iranian positions within Syria if they're thinking about retaliating. It doesn't matter if it's true or not. There needs to be no evidence. There needs to be no proof of it. Obviously, Israel can open bomb shelters whenever they want, regardless of if there's a real or a perceived threat. They merely have to say it because people see that headline, which is all over the country right now, having to open bomb shelters, despite there actually being reason for it or logic behind it when you're the aggressor in the situation, is quite telling. However, I think as much as people feel a sense of nerve or panic, which you obviously would, they also realize that Benjamin Netanyahu is not a credible leader in many ways and is going under his own corruption charges within the country right now. That as much as they see that he's bad, as much as people speak out against Donald Trump, they're still able to get away with it because people aren't either engaged politically because they do not know how, or they're simply burnt out. We have to remember in the United States, 90 million people didn't vote in the last election. why is Donald Trump able to drop bombs in Syria unchecked? Why is he able to drop bombs in Afghanistan or continue to have troop levels in the Middle East? Is simply because people aren't engaged. They can read the headlines. They know Donald Trump may be an idiot or they may not agree with him, but they're not able to stop his actions or change it. I mean, we saw the Iranian deal passed in the first place by a very well-organized non-government organization to even get that Iran deal through. Why is it now falling apart with relative ease compared to what it took to get the deal in the first place? Is because the Donald Trumps of the world control headlines and there's unactivated populace speaking out against it. So I think there's a lot of cross threats between what's happening in the United States and Israel, which is faster right now, is that the leaders are using headlines and scare tactics, but people aren't mobilizing strongly enough to stop them from using it.
In the U.S. media, Trump's move, the decision to move the embassy, U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, which, of course, Jerusalem is a historic Arab city, its status even by international law, including the U.N. charter that established the State of Israel, was to be neutral. It wasn't to be controlled by, certainly not by Israel, and to recognize Jerusalem as the capital. That's a big move. Now, Trump isn't the first one. I mean, other administrations, including Democratic Party administrations, have said that they wanted to do that, but they always put it on hold. And when Trump did this thing, made the announcement, Schumer and the Democrats, they were pretty much either muted or supporting him.
Standing ovation for Chuck Schumer when Donald Trump announced the embassy move. Jerusalem, it is an interesting move. I think the sense of just the small number I've been able to talk to is that it's a unilateral decision by the United States that will do no one favors on the ground here. This does not improve Palestinian and Israeli relations whatsoever. It only muddies the waters, and it's not seen as being anything that any Israeli citizen had any say over. As much as some obviously are calling for it, it feels like a Donald Trump move. It feels like a U.S.-imposed move. The first people I talked to about it were a group of six young soldiers who felt that there would be major security concerns for any Israeli soldier having to protect that embassy now in Jerusalem, and saying basically, look, this is going to cost an Israeli soldier their life at some point here. And if it costs one Israeli soldier their life, it's not worth the United States getting their embassy moved. And so I think if you're hearing that from the soldiers of the streets, and you're not hearing anybody outside of the far right really supporting it, or some of your American evangelical community groups, broadly speaking, I don't think this move is going to be welcomed. And it seems like a lot of people are starting to mobilize towards Jerusalem over the weekend and for Monday's range of protest.
And who is going to be engaged in those protests? Who are they? Are they Palestinians? Are they Muslims? Are there parts of the Israeli Jewish population that's also protesting against this?
We'll see. I mean, the people that I've obviously talked to have been your normal organizations and organizers who have obviously been doing a lot lately around immigration issues for African migrants in the country are speaking out and who's usually there. Of course, I think the telling thing will be how many people come that aren't usually there. If these movements aren't growing, if, like I said, people are feeling burnt out, they're feeling unengaged, to shift the tide, you'll need people that haven't been there before to show up. And I think that ultimately is the question we'll be reporting on Monday from Jerusalem, is who showed up that wouldn't normally show up. Is Bibi coming to an endpoint? Is this going to hurt Donald Trump in relation? Or do people relatively stay home and the groups that are always out there don't have backups, allowing for the U.S. to have its embassy and add even more complexity to one of the world's longest standing conflicts?
Bob Schlehuber is our guest. We're talking to Bob from Jerusalem. He's normally here in Washington, D.C. in the Sputnik studio, where he's the producer of the show By Any Means Necessary with Eugene Preyer and Sean Blackman. But Bob is there in Jerusalem because we're going to be covering the U.S. Embassy opening in Jerusalem, which will take place next week. Bob, as you mentioned or alluded to, Benjamin Netanyahu is facing numerous corruption charges. I don't know, and I think other members of his family, including his wife, are as well. I wonder what the what his base of support is, and my second question, because we only have 2 minutes left, again, I'm trying to take the temperature of the Israeli population, the Israeli non-Arab population, regarding the shootings that the Israeli Defense Forces have been committing every Friday for the past few weeks against unarmed Palestinian demonstrators, a huge number of people shot with so-called rubber bullets, but those are rubber bullets that kill people, and you know, many, many have been killed. More than 1,000 or almost 2,000 or more have been wounded. What's the reaction to from the Israeli population about that?
Again, as much as people, I think, are aware, it's ultimately a few groups fighting for it. I think we have to remember that so much of these shootings, like in the United States with police killings, are justified by law. You have laws that are written in a way in which police officers can merely say they felt threatened, that these soldiers here in Israel can merely say there's a perceived threat, we feel threatened, these are incursions on the borders. And even if they are doing something illegal, there's then a lag time in actually stopping the government or police forces from continuing to do these actions. And so I think so much of it right now with the shootings along Gaza is a legal issue that is being tried in the courts. But again, ultimately, the headlines people are aware of, people are conscious of, people are paying attention to, but how exactly are they moving against it is the question to be discovered. And until those laws are changed that stop and actually have punishment against the military for shooting the Gazans on the border and the disgusting ramifications from shooting these unarmed citizens comes with, until there's actually a legal ramifications, they're going to continue. And I think people either are aware of it and don't know how to change it, or there's just not nearly enough people that are aware of it.
Do they support it?
Hey, if they're not fighting against it, it's hard to say that they are against it.
Okay. Anyway, we'll leave it right there. We've been joined from Jerusalem by Bob Schlehuber, producer of the Radio Sputnik show, By Any Means Necessary. You can hear his coverage starting next week, of course, when the U.S. Embassy is opened officially in Jerusalem. We're completely out of time. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can also follow us at Loud Clear Radio on Twitter. If you're in the Washington, D.C. area, you can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and at 1390 AM. You can also subscribe to it as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and clear. Thank you.